Good evening. I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Lectures and Literature at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina here on KALW. Bina is a Hebrew term meaning insight and understanding, and in Kabbalah, it's the primordial womb from which creativity flows. In this series, we'll bring you the voices of people who are very much part of today's creative flow, who've come to speak at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. This series is made possible by the Richard and Rhoda Goldman Center for Adult Living and Learning and the Toby Center for Jewish Life. The JCCSF is a beneficiary of the Jewish Community Federation. On tonight's Bina, we hear from artist Wayne Tebow, whose paintings run the gamut from cupcakes to cityscapes. And now join the New Yorker's Adam Gopnik in conversation with Wayne Tebow.
I've always wanted to ask you this because it's something that I've always wanted to do. If I wanted to learn to paint, if I wanted to try and translate, doing verbal stuff into visual stuff, what would be the first thing you would have me do? You're a great teacher. What would be the first primal act of drawing and painting, thinking visually?
I think give you a pencil.
What would that be?
No, probably a 2H. An egg. A white sheet of paper. Put the egg in the middle of the sheet of paper. And have you try to replicate what's happening to the light on that egg.
So I'd have the egg, the paper, and the pencil. It sounds like a Zen exercise.
Well, there's a lot of Zen in any kind of deep thinking, right? So it is a lot about the first thing, I guess, that you try to teach, if it can be taught, is to tell people you're not going to teach them how to draw, really, or anything about art, but to learn how to see, and see more deeply, more carefully, more analytically than you've ever seen in your life before.
And how do you go about doing that? How do you keep that? I know a favorite word of yours, Wayne, is inquiry, that you love that word and the idea of inquiry. How do you keep that inquiry alive over decades and decades? How do you continue to learn to see?
I think it's difficult because it has a high fatigue factor. Any kind of concentration of that kind is of that nature, and it's why we lose a lot of people in terms of thinking about becoming a painter or a drawer. Because a lot of it isn't fun. It's work. You don't like to be criticized. You have a hard time learning how to be critical of your own work, if that's ever possible to the degree that it should be. So all of those factors of those conditions sound to me like that's something I never want to do or have anybody do in the world before. But along with that is this marvelous experience of being willing to make yourself vulnerable, exposed, open, as they say, open to experience. And if, as in the case of students, the wonder is that they are in that way the ones that want to learn something.
Let's go back to the beginning, Wayne. You, as a young man, a kid growing up in Southern California, being a painter, choosing that as a destiny, finding it as a vocation, it wasn't in those years the same as growing up in 15th century Florence. It wasn't the obvious thing for a young guy to do. When did the vocation enter your head? When did it come into your hand? When did you know, when did you have that moment you said, this is what I'm going to do, whether anybody wants me to or not?
Well, that's much too fancy a kind of ambition to even have me think about, because I didn't even know anything about being a painter, really. I wanted to be a cartoonist, so I'd go to the library and check out books on how you be a cartoonist. And
A cartoonist, a comic strip artist like E.C. Seeger or
a just learning editorial what cartooning cartoonist? Was. Uh-huh. You know, cartooning is so-and-so. You make a round circle. You put two circles in it, plus a little, two tiny dots, and then a little kind of smile, and you have a face. That's magic. They also show you how to do something that I still think is one of the most wonderful visual happenings that I know, and that's to learn that on a flat piece of paper you can draw a square and then draw another square in back of it and then hook up the lines from one point to another and you have space. Fictional space, but space that warms your heart. Look at that. I've made this paper have space. It isn't, you don't need much to love drawing and painting. It's, everybody should do it. Every school student, all through their educational experience. Even if they keep on drawing that little box, doesn't matter. I still do it when I'm talking on the telephone. I like it so much. Yes. But there's something about that whole notion of turning a flat piece of paper or canvas into something other than it is. And so back to your good question about when you think about becoming something like a painter, that's a serious business. And I still wonder if that's what I want to do.
Well, the rest of us don't.
But, you know, it's enough. The wonderful thing is if you can get rid of the idea of being an artist, I think.
That is, being an artist rather than a painter. That yeah. You're a painter, not an artist.
Then you're, I think, a lot happier.
No, explain that to us. In other words, when you give up the idea of... So when you give up a certain kind of pretension, do you mean where you give up the idea of being self-consciously an artiste and you simply yeah. focus in that Zen-like way on the act of
right.
making marks with pigments?
I guess it's because, at least in my opinion, first of all, we don't know what an artist is or what art is, although we always think we do, and we have lots of wonderful people who tell us what it is. But the reason we don't know what it is it's still being formed, right? I mean, what we need is that openness to the possibilities of what art might finally tell us more than we know now. But painting isn't necessarily like that. I don't think, at least, that it's enough just to make a little world of your own making. And if you then think, well, I'm an artist, therefore everything I do is art, then you're in a very difficult position because you've got to then say, well, what is it that you do that's art? How do you define it? And that's fascinating and unending in terms of the conditions by which aestheticians, philosophers, have written some of the most engaging and interesting, fascinating speculations. But if you compare that with something like a painting, that's a tough juxtaposition, isn't it? I mean, here is this flat, still, immovable object. And it just lays there or hangs on a wall. And it's dead. I mean, there's nothing there. Unless you bring to that its life. So the most interesting thing, if you could do this, if you could say, as a painter, What would be your ideal audience? Say one person who comes to this still dead object. You don't know each other. We're strangers. I'm the painter. They're the looker. What is there there if they don't know anything about me, if they don't know anything about reputations, they don't know about prices, they don't know about the art world, they look at this thing. What's there for them? If they haven't read about it, if they haven't studied art history, this is an ideal point, it seems to me. Because there's a chance for two people to connect in the most intimate, special way, a shared physical, bodily, mental connection. Something we need so desperately just to feel that it's worth connecting to each other with the same feelings, the same loves, the same problems, all of that. Here's this little thing, which is an egg on a white piece of paper casting a shadow.
So your ideal interaction, use a terrible word, is more like that of a reader coming to a poem than
right.
It is a student coming to a right. knotty problem or a professor coming to
right.
the next point. And you want to keep that you want to keep that exchange intact, if you can.
It'd be nice also if they'd buy it.
They probably can't afford it anymore. Take us...
Well.
Let me leap ahead then. As long as we're on this line of conversation, Wayne, let me leap ahead to one of the things I wanted to ask you at the end, but I'll ask you now. That is, every day you read the painting is dead. That you read, you have smart young art critics, like my little brother, for instance, who's one of the smartest of them, who feel essentially that painting is over, that was an episode merely in the history of Western art, and that same spirit, which once resided in painting, now resides in video or installations.
Right.
You've heard that. I'm sure you've heard this and had students who told you this and so on.
Right.
That's an old-fashioned medium of these sticky pigments that you put on canvas, and that it may be wonderful in a nostalgic way, but that it's dead. What do you say to someone who believes that or says that?
Well, I think it's, as we said a little bit earlier, it is easy to see how that condition occurs, and this is not the first time that people have talked about. Centuries ago, they talked about that in various ways, various cultures, and various conditions. But the answer, if there is any answer at all for me, is that it's alive only for me. And when I go, as I might be privileged to go to the Metropolitan Museum, I go to this private, almost like a private game reserve, where there are these examples of painting from the beginning to now, which are full of all of the things which human beings, or as many things as human beings, have experienced. So you're seeing a kind of anthology of human thought and human processes. So that you come through that and to that, these terrific high points and low points of painting, or up and down, in all cultures. And it is so easy then to say to yourself, well, nothing's been, I mean, everything's been done, nothing is possible now. Particularly in view of our big, buzzing, confusing world full of all this visual energy. But if you think for a minute about something else in your lives, what are those intimate things that we do? What things are there still remaining which are still so much a part of just our daily, very plain lives? And it seems to me this is where painting finally can reside. That idea of using your body duplicated in this little flat surface with the skin, the texture, the same kind of, in many ways, chemical makeup, its muscularity, all of these things you must enliven the painting with. In other words, your sense of equilibrium. Is that egg sitting on that piece of paper? Or is it about to roll down? Is the volume of the egg properly nuanced? And you experience this in addition to the way in which you go about your daily lives. Just the intimacy with which you touch things. The way in which you prepare meals. Now, these are very unfancy ideas. So let me carry it one step further. There are two kinds of painting, it seems to me, in the last couple of hundred years. There are that wonderful band of avant-garde people who try to indicate in their work the idea of complexity and chaos, contradictions, this world which is so confused that we must in some ways echo that and try to deal with that concept. It's a very fascinating area of painting. The most interesting part about it for me is within its structures, this anxiety of disclosure. That is, if we're going to try and make a kind of summing up of this notion, we find it's going to be impossible. But if we step back and slightly nuance the idea of not quite knowing, that keeping muteness, the kind of absolute disclosure, the wonderful kind of feeling of finishing up, then we're done for. Now, if you contrast that with another kind of painting, my kind of painting, for instance, to go down the lower levels, is it is a resolution. It's just there, unchanging. The only people who can change it are the people who look at it. They say, there's a rotten piece of work right there. Or, I like it. And this response is quite different from the other kind of parallel. Both are fascinating, both are necessary, but they are very different. And this is a long speech.
No, finish.
So if painting is to survive, it has to survive, I think, on a level of low expectancy. But that low expectancy is where we live. Think of the opposite of that, which are these grand plans. Remember those paintings of, they used to call them machines, of history painting, and these are like the themes of yearning we all have, of the big idea, grandness, to the point of, as we now find people saying, art can take the place of God. Really? That's an impossible idea. And this idea is carried on to the concept that is way beyond us. Transcendence is such a marvelous idea, and these grand plans are without equal, but they also are the results of ideologies carried to the extreme of grand opera. And grand opera is not how we live. So painting, I'm talking about sign painting, cartooning, illustration, motel painting of pink dogs, little flower paintings, all of that, because this is the longest rationalization I've ever made for my own painting.
Go on, finish it. You're this close to the finish line.
Isn't that awful?
So all of it, Sunday painting, the painting my grandfather does, all of that painting is where painting is.
Yes, and will stay, I think, because we got hands and bodies, and that's where it'll reside. It may sleep along in that for a long time. All of a sudden, who knows, we may need it again on another level. And there are a lot of people standing ready to do that. Take Neil Roche or Grand Themes of Sculpture. All of those are always around waiting. But we have to be careful again, I think, about over-expecting painting. I think that really almost, if it hasn't ruined it, having this, as de Kooning once said something like, "God damn, they're going to break the back of painting with all this over-expectancy." It was. It's just a goddamn piece of paper with something smeared on it. That's all it is.
Wayne, that is such an eloquent and encompassing answer that if I were, as I wish I were, a Zen adept, I would get us both up right now and leave the hall. But unfortunately, this is a Jewish environment, so we have to go on talking way beyond the necessities of life. So, but I'm going to ask them to preserve that, because I think that's a profound answer. And it makes me think of something that, in fact, that I once scribbled down about your work, which is that it always tries to be modest but not minor and doesn't confuse modesty with minority.
You're listening to artist Wayne Thiebaud in conversation with the New Yorker's Adam Gopnik on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco.
But come back, if you would, for me. You're a young guy. You love cartooning, and you just want to be a cartoonist. And I should add to you, you were a terrific cartoonist. The first time you and I ever met at long distance was after I wrote what now seems to be an insanely pretentious piece about George Harriman and Crazy Cat that you had enjoyed. And out of the blue, I got an envelope with a perfect pastiche of a Crazy Cat panel that just came through the mailbox. It was a perfect impression of a Crazy Cat panel, and it was from Wayne Thiebaud. And I was stunned. So you were very good at it. But take us through the next leap then, from a kid who's fascinated by the schematics of cartooning to somebody who thinks there might be even more in that kind of expression.
Well, yes. I mean, I'm still a cartoonist, really. Do cartoons all the time. And I think, rightly so, a lot of critics think that the work is cartooning. They don't realize that's a compliment to me. And I mean that very seriously, because I collect original cartoons and that whole thing. But if we go on from there, I got more and more interested in drawing, went to drawing classes. I didn't go to art school, but I had a lot of wonderful people, because I worked as a sign painter and a fashion illustrator, all of those kind of things, which I have an awful lot of respect for. And that was where I was. That's where I planned to be until I saw or sensed they'd have these art director annuals where they show the best work of design, the best work of so on. I always go to those and was always marvelously impressed. In reading more and more about art history, which I was also interested in, and realized certainly that all of that, all of the conventions and most of the character of the work in commercial art is very much in the training of regular art schools. They go to, designers go to the same art schools, as they learn to draw from the human figure, they do how to draw, and then they go into things like lettering. But lettering, you know, you could teach life drawing by having people learn to imitate typography, because it's based on the same kind of negative, positive shape alien alternation, the same sort of physical equilibrium, kind of sense of spacing. So you get the continuum of tonal gradations. All of those things are the same thing, but they come then at a great price in terms of levels of achievement. And almost all the great designers that I happen to know and privileged to know love fine art and were very much influenced by it. So you see designers coming through various conventions, the conventions of Mondrian or of even of Degas, Matisse, and fashion design, all of these abstract painters who will work for so long to get just something right. Where, how is that orange operating within this structure? Very much like any kind of abstract. What am I going on about this for? It's getting
me on. Because you're talking about the connection between illustration and
more and more that I was in advertising and doing that and working, and slowly got more and more interested in trying. Yeah, I want to try and paint, and I didn't know how to paint, so I'd just go and see how people did it, and I'd try to imitate it, try to copy it, and I looked for all those signs of art, you know, the drip. You say, I got to have some drips in this, because real paintings have drips. And,
this is in the smears. 40s. This is in
Right. So abstract expressionism, I painted that, try to do that, and try to do...
Were you seeing that, Wayne, in art magazines?
In art magazines and in exhibitions that would come west. And then I met a very important fellow in my life who was what we would call a fine artist or a serious artist. That was Robert Mallory. And he gave me my first criticism, told me how dumb I was and how much I had to learn. And that was like going to any school. You simply had the privilege of being challenged, try to get better at what you do and so on. And that's when I left the commercial art world, went back to school on the GI Bill, got a degree so I could teach, because I had a family. And this is the longest story of my life you'll ever hear.
How long have you been married, Wayne?
47 years this year.
Oh, fantastic. That's fantastic. Yes, exactly. I will go. We'll come back on your 50. So that takes you. That takes up to you. Now you're becoming a painter. You know, you've decided you're going to teach.
Yeah.
And you're exposed at this point mostly, some firsthand, some secondhand, to stuff that seemed very important coming out of New York.
Right.
And then,
very much so.
Did you go to New York in those years to look at what was going
yes,
on?
Yes, and I started teaching at a city college in Sacramento, and then in 1956, because all of my heroes then became the abstract expressionists and others, and I decided to take time off. Went back to New York in 1956 and had the wonderful time when it was still a kind of generous art world, approachable.
A village rather than a
village.
Than an armory.
Right. And you'd see everybody, all of the people now who are the famous names you hear about, de Kooning, all the critics, were all in one group, and they had a place called The Club, which I attended on Friday nights, and the Cedar Tavern, where you could listen to them argue and talk, and so on. And that was a great, fundamentally changing year, because meeting the painters as opposed to reading about them reading what the critics were saying as opposed to what they would talk about. That was a wonderful kind of transforming kind of experience. And
Can you give us more detail on that way? In other words, they were materialists and the critics were blowhards? I mean,
Well, de Kooning would say something like this. He said, I talked to this fellow, came to me, we had sat down, he says, I want to talk to you. He says, he has a Dutch accent, so I'm trying to make some kind of... He said, goddamn guy was here 10 minutes, he wrote a 350-page book on the work. He says, or more directly, it would be something different, and it's fascinating because they would be talking about him with something like, you have achieved a monumental breakthrough in the concept of non-environmental space in your work. And de Kooning would say, that's right, I guess. But he would be, seriously, he would say, they talk a lot about Picasso in my own work, but, and of course Picasso was very important, but I love Rembrandt. And really, Soutine. Well, you right away you can see what that means directly, because it's visual. And it's more of a one-to-one relationship to what he was actually doing.
I remember we once went through a de Kooning show together. Do you recall this?
Yes,
and you pointed out to me that how many of de Kooning's sort of automatic forms, the things that were just in his hands, were sort of schematic memories of life drawing, that they're
right,
kind
exactly.
of their anatomical form. They're not anatomical forms, they're shorthand
right,
for anatomical
that's right.
forms.
Of the kinds conventions of
the, that a European
yeah.
painter would have just soaked up in
that's
that
right,
way.
Yeah.
And so that kind of, that sense of painting as natural physical expression rather than mm-hmm. abstract idea was important
right.
to you, and that's what you felt in, yeah. in 56, 57.
And I think also he said something which I will never forget, and I tell my students. He said, one of the things to avoid is becoming an art world employee. And you know exactly what he meant if you were in New York at that time with the beginning and burgeoning effect of what was going to happen to the money interests, the whole concept of publicity, the engines of publicity were warming up, and as a result now you have this fantastic machine of art, and that can be so seductive and so fascinating that it can almost make you give up. It's hard enough to be a painter anyway when you go to the Metropolitan Museum. What the hell am I doing painting pictures? Well, you have to just love doing it. You know, you have to love. I don't care, really, in a way, except this. Just so wonderful to flip that brush, you know, and all the time you're doing that, you're encapsulating all of the stuff, all those marvelous painters. It's, you know, I'm still making de Kooning brushstroke, you know.
Just it. I want to take the story up to the next stage, but just to digress for a moment. When you went to the Metropolitan in those days, or when you go now, who are the painters who mean most to you? Who do you draw sustenance from most steadily? I remember I was making up a list of favorite painters once, and you stuck Vermeer in it. I had forgotten Vermeer, of the greatest pure painters. And I've always wondered if that was a part of that experience.
Yes, certainly. You know what they ought to do is put a Mondrian and a Franz Klein with a Vermeer in the middle of it in the Metropolitan and let you see the kind of range of painting.
What painting can be.
And all the things in between leading up to the nuances of, yeah. You had...
Well, let's say, you were drawn to, and actually had a lot of, some experience of, that moment of abstract painting in New York. And yet, when you come back here, and you don't go abstract, you don't, unlike Dick Diebenkorn say, you don't make that turn.
No.
But you begin right then, in the late 50s, early 60s, you find your subject. You find the subject, at least, that became most strongly associated with you.
There was one thing, again, which happened, and I think they made a real tattletale evidence of what I was doing, saying, you know, what you're doing with all these influences you're going through is trying to make the signs of art, and you can't do that. You know? You can't make your mind up and say, I'm going to make it look like art, because if you make it look like art, it's probably somebody else's. But if you are willing to sort of throw yourself on the mercy of yourself and your interests and what it is you really love or want to do, then that's plenty.
And that's when you made your great breakthrough towards
And Adam would be bored by this because he's heard it, I think, already, that I came home, and that's when I went out in the studio, and I tried to make a painting like I'd been making before, and I just said, I've got to start over. And I remember putting up this canvas, and I said, I'm going to go back to the most basic things I know. And so I got a rectangle, and I remember Cezanne saying, painting rests on the idea of the cube, the cone, and the square. Cube, cone, cylinder, was it?
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I'm going to see if I can make those things stay in their places. And I'd been working in restaurants as a kid in Long Beach. And I said, I'm going to try to see if I can put some things down that I haven't seen in painting. So I remember making ovals and putting these triangular pie-like shapes, and then made it into pies, I remember. This is a very embarrassing remembrance, because I got through, and there were these six or seven plates with pies and pumpkin pies, trying to think, what's pumpkin color like? And I mixed it up, and I said, that looks awful. And I put it on, and it looked awful in this triangle. So I said, that looks terrible. It's like somebody smeared something on there that I don't like. So I had to put little pieces of, there were underdrawings of colors. So I left those in and went on, and then had this suddenly on the easel looking at it. I thought, well, that's the end of me. I've got myself a painting of pies.
No future in that. It's absolutely...
I am never going to be taken seriously.
But that's such a beautiful story, because it's exactly what every artist... It's the moment every artist needs of a breakthrough by reduction to the essentials rather than by complication.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Tonight's program features artist Wayne Thiebaud in conversation with The New Yorker's Adam Gopnik.
But, you know, I've always wanted to ask you this. I hadn't actually heard that story, but I have always wanted to ask you. You are such a gracious man that you would never say this, but I'm going to put you on the spot before this audience to say it. Aren't there times when you just get sick of people thinking of you as the pie guy? That, you know, it's as though, I mean, I'm sure because you hear it every day, right? You know, oh, Mr. Thiebaud, I love your work so much because I love to bake, you know, and that sort of thing. And that it's like coming to Cezanne and saying, it's for me, pears are everything. I just love pears. I love pear juice. I love pear salads. And that's why I love your work. Thank you. There must be a moment, right, Wayne, when you just are inclined to say, it has nothing in goddamn world to do with pies or cakes. I'm working on in a tradition still life. It has to do with geometry. It has to do with space. It could be cups. It could be fruit. It just happens to be that because I have a pleasant association with it. Please, no, I have true. Go away.
Well, I think what you hope for is someone will come up and tell you, hate those pie paintings of yours. But that little figure painting you made, that's kind of interesting. That's a nice moment when they do that. But I just feel like I'd be an ingrate if I didn't appreciate people liking the pies as well.
As pies, rather than primarily as paintings. But then something else, and I know we need to go to the public questions, but let me just take you up so we can come to the, in quick fashion, towards the end of what you were doing. Then something strange happened, which we have talked about, and that is that work that you were doing, which was all about the rediscovery of the sincerity of your own inquiry, if you like, mm-hmm. happened to take place at a time when there was the explosion of pop art. And for a while, anyway, mm-hmm. what you were doing, which was, in the Zen sense, absolutely sincere and mindful, was read as ironic and satiric. And that happened. How did you...
Well, I've just never felt I was a card-carrying pop artist. I think one of the reasons is that I don't care for it very much.
For the pop artists on the...
Yeah, for the pop art movement. I mean, certainly there are wonderful painters in that movement. But the ideas, irony and some of the other things which Adam mentions for me... don't really declare themselves for me in any real legitimate, genuine way. And I think part of it is because so much of it comes back-turning from the commercial world, which I was in for some good time. And somewhat unfairly, I think, the sources from which so much of that bad pop art came from is not credited. That bothers me. But basically, it's just that the work.
I think I know what you mean, Wayne. But it's a little bit cryptic. Do you mean that the kinds of things, in plain English, that Roy Lichtenstein did, say borrowing or appropriating from cartoonists, involved a condescension to the actual cartoonists who had made the forms that those pictures were based on, and that condescension annoys you?
And. One thing which I'd like to talk about very briefly, if we have a second, is the difference between photography and painting.
Please.
And since now, I don't know what your estimates would be, but I would say, in my own feeling, something like 80 to 90% of the images which we see are based on some sort of photographic or technological medium for its visual enterprise, as opposed to something like drawing and painting. That, to me, is a fascinating phenomenon. And just to make a short difference between what painting is as opposed to photography, and it isn't anything to take away from photography, which is a sensational medium. But those things all belong together, I think. Photography, filmmaking, video, those are marvelous, transcendent mediums and possibilities. But when you think of painting has to go from nothing to something, blankness to something. Photography goes from the world into something. And this is a big difference. And art departments, which are housing parallel photographic courses, are, in a sense, making it very difficult to get kids to draw and paint. And for me, this is a serious problem.
Because, say that again, Wayne, because I'm not sure I followed it completely. Because what's the difference in, what does the painting does for you, the photography can't do? It goes...
Painting has to come from nothing to something.
And photography always begins with something, with the thing that is, and then has to make more of it.
Yeah.
So we betray the basis of painting in...
And it leaves out the body. Mm-hmm. I mean, it isn't that you don't take pictures of the body and you don't sense the body and don't use the body, but I'm talking about the physicality, the thing we said earlier, the skin, the texture, the
all those things that have to soak into your hand in order right. to... In
A
order
handmade
to.
Thing. And photography is not handmade.
I want to come to questions of the audience, but let me ask you one more question before I go here, because it's another one of the commonplaces about your work, which nonetheless I think is rich, and that is your California. You no. and Richard Diamond Cornell are the two kind of grand masters, Diamond Cornell gone, of California art, and you've lived your life here, and much of your work involves subject matter that seems to that draws on this place. At the same time, I know you don't want to seem to be a local or provincial artist. How do you feel about that designation, and how do you feel about the place where you've spent your life?
I do have a difficulty with the fact that they called Richard Diamond Cornell for so long a time, from based in New York, a California painter. And painting is only one thing. I mean, certainly there's all kinds of indigenous changes and geographical reasons why painting looks one way or another and all that, but the structure of what painting is, a way of reducing the three-dimensional world to a two-dimensional surface in various ways, that's as basic as mathematics. So calling a California, you know, that's California painter, that's like saying, well, he's a California mathematician or California physics professor or whatever. It just doesn't, I think, legitimately make any sense. But what do you think about that?
Well, you know, Auden said once, I think I quoted this in an essay I wrote about your work, that an artist's goal, a poet's goal, is to be like a valley cheese, local but prized elsewhere. Yeah. There's a negative sense in which we condescend to artists outside the Rome or Paris or New York or wherever it might be at a particular moment by saying, oh, he's a California painter. Yeah. But there's another sense in which that it's exactly that the particularity of what you do, a particularity of light, of subject, of preoccupations and obsessions, whether that's Rembrandt in... You know, Rembrandt is a Dutch painter or Manet very much a Parisian painter, that part of the glory of painting is that it can be intensely local in feeling and it's universal.
That would be better than to just call you a hick painter. I like that.
I think maybe put it another way, all good painters are hick painters because part of being a painter means...
Because Grunwald.
Yeah, exactly. It means being intensely... paying intense attention to one thing rather than an abstract idea of things. That's the positive sense in which I think it's there. All right, let's let the audience in into this duologue.
Be kind.
Someone asks, did you know Rube Goldberg? Were you influenced by his cartoons, and are you impressed by his work?
Very much so, yes. I have an original drawing of his, Rube Goldberg. He's wonderful. He's better than Duchamp for me.
Yes. No,
you know, I don't know, we shouldn't say better. We should say...
We can say better.
Like.
We can say better. Mr. Thiebaud, in describing the primal act of making art, i.e. the pen, paper, egg scenario, you call it an act of deep thinking. What is the relation between seeing and thinking? And I'll tiptoe away here, Wayne, and let you take this one for the next 2 days.
Last sentence, what was it?
What is the relation between seeing and thinking? In other words, do you, as an artist, want to empty your mind? One often hears that in art classes. So the thing to do is to empty your mind of preconceptions and just see. Do you believe in that, or is...
Well, let me just... We'll talk about how you see. Here's what you have to do in your thinking of seeing. You're looking at this egg, and... You're trying to draw it. So you look at the edge, and you see the edge always, whenever you focus your eye. You have to learn, and this is something you could call editing, you have to learn how to squint at the egg, how to open your eye and stare at the egg, how to stare at two places if you can simultaneously, how to remember the egg when you're not seeing it, and bring these all together into a whole. The same with light. There's light which is glaring, light which is glimmers, gleams, glows. Your thinking in terms of your seeing have to coincide or parallel in order to get that job to look special. It's not hard to get it adequate, but then there's that question of specialness, that special egg. Think in your mind if Aang drew that egg, what would it look like? Would it look like that back of the Turkish bather, where the nuances of that back are a condition of value sensibility in relationship, which is transcendent, to use a painting term. So special that, you know, you just have to see better than other people so you don't bore them to death. I'm not talking about me. I'm just talking about student exercises where you have to really be willing to look and see and think and make mistakes, all of that to get to. A parallel would be how you do it with hearing. If you're sitting around a dinner table, you hear clinking and bobbing and swallowing and all that. But think if you had to hear extrasensorily. So you'd hear stomach grumbling and God knows what else. But you'd be hearing things which the ordinary person passes up without that concentration. I think I'm back, feel like I'm back teaching somehow back here. It's terrible. You should never, that's the trouble with professors. They can talk more and more about less and less all the time.
I think you answered the question. Somebody asks about something very specific about teaching. Can you speak about the culture at UC Davis with Roy DeForest, Manuel Neri, Bob Arneson, William Wiley, and others, and the interaction among them? Maybe to broaden the question, what you've spent a lot of your life as a on faculties.
We were very lucky. We were just a bunch of bums, all doing different things. And the person who gets credit, should get credit for that, is a man by the name of Richard L. Nelson. And they fortunately named a little gallery for him there. But his idea was to get his, what he could find as people that he could employ who were as very different as possible, who did as many different things. William Wiley and Manuel Neri and Roy DeForest and Robert Arneson and a number of others who were all very, very different people. And then put them in the department and, well, on the one hand, it was chaotic and strange and curious. The students were baffled. Wiley would come in and write on the blackboard, ice. And he'd say, I'll see you in a couple of hours, see what you do. And I would come in with my egg and pencil. So you had this group of nuts in the department. The nice thing was that we all liked each other and we all admired each other and we all got along and we were very interested in teaching. And the students and the faculty were all very close. So that was one of those lucky accidents was a very pleasureable thing to be part of.
And of course it created the famous California Cold Egg School of Painting amongst the students. Someone else asks, I love your blue shadows. Do you choose color intuitively or by design? And it's certainly true, Wayne, that within your pictures, which at first glance, have a window-like appearance. In fact, there are many, what shall we call them, strange, hallucinatory, expressionist elements.
This just comes out of fauvism, really, and the interaction of colors. I really didn't know anything about color and tried to read about it, but what I really did was to look an awful lot at Bonnard and Indian miniature painting, Persian painting, Eastern painting, where color takes on or tries to take on its own form, its own character, so that you create light by the interaction of color as opposed to copying light, like on that egg, for instance. They're just different systems. And shadows might become blue because they, in that particular instance, and the word design is very well put, because they're chosen to try and accommodate whatever is needed or feel like you need in that particular area to be enlivened or to create energy. And the idea of object and shadow is an enduring, continuing problem of interchange. You're always trying to figure out both the substance of something and its counterpart and how those work together. So that shadows are amazing, fascinating units of potential that are marvelous to orchestrate with objects. And you can do a lot of various things with shadows that you can't necessarily do with the object. So, but that's about... Does that answer the question at all?
Beautifully, I think.
But let me just say something in final thought for me. Your paintings, it would be wise if you never finished your paintings. Then it would still rest on the notion of being evolving. Because you can never do a painting which is as good as the one you thought about in your mind or one you wanted to do. So that's the kind of wonder of painting.
Thank you so much.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the Jewish Community Center, you can visit jccsf.org. This program is made possible by the Richard and Rhoda Goldman Center for Adult Living and Learning and the Toby Center for Jewish Life. The JCCSF is a beneficiary of the Jewish Community Federation. Michael Geese Graphics and Brandon Battaglia are the recording engineers at the JCCSF. Dan Gunning edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. I invite you to tune in again next Monday evening at 8, when Bina will feature controversial film director Oliver Stone on politics and war. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.